our CEQA scoping meeting on a proposed aquatic ecosystem restoration policy.
Yes. Well, good afternoon. My name is Alita Mangelsdorf, and I am an environmental scientist in our basin planning unit. I've been working on developing an aquatic ecosystem restoration policy for your consideration in to adopt into the basin plan. Hopefully, we'll have that ready for you sometime early next year. So this is the first in a series of workshops or presentations that will happen over the course of the development of this policy. This is a CEQA scoping meeting. Our hope here is to get some feedback from the board and from the public on the scope of the project and the CEQA analysis that we'll be undertaking. We have two CEQA scoping meetings scheduled. Today is the first here in Santa Rosa, and then we have another one next week on Tuesday, November 8th, up in Weaverville. Before I get started on the actual presentation, I just wanted to alert people to the fact that there are materials out on the in the lobby there. There's a copy of the public notice. There's a copy of the CEQA scoping document. And there's a copy of my presentation, if any of you would like to have that. Also, for the purpose of keeping track of participants here in the meeting and making sure that you get updated as the policy is better defined, there's a notebook up front for people to sign in, and it's our general sign-in sheet for the board meeting. So if you would just put a check mark by your name to let me know that you're specifically interested in receiving information on this, I would appreciate that. Okay, so the purpose of a CEQA scoping meeting is to provide a forum for early public involvement on the development of an aquatic ecosystem restoration policy and the analysis of potential environmental effects that may be associated with implementation of the policy. We, as I said, we have two CEQA scoping meetings scheduled today and again next Tuesday in Weaverville. We'll be receiving public comments on the scoping document up through November 18th. And so that, for those of you who may have missed the public notice, that's an extension of the original date. So again, November 18th. So let me outline what I hope to cover in the presentation. First, I will talk about the reasons for developing an aquatic ecosystem restoration policy. The board directed staff in its last triennial review to develop an exemption criteria for restoration projects. And it, in thinking about how to go about doing that, we staff decided that it would be nice to couch that within a larger restoration policy, which would give the board an opportunity to voice support for restoration generally as a water quality protection tool, rather than solely seeing it as a waste discharge permitted activity. I will go over, provide a brief overview of our existing regulatory framework. Restoration projects are sometimes construction projects and can themselves result in waste discharge. Sometimes those discharges are significant. They have significant temporary impacts. But well-designed restoration projects truly augment our regulatory efforts to control water pollution and protect beneficial uses in the long term. So there is this balancing that is unique to restoration projects, different from most of the other kinds of permits that we issue. Then I'm going to provide a few examples of aquatic ecosystem restoration projects that we've been involved with in the past. In fact, it's only two projects that I'll show pictures of, but they sort of represent the extreme examples, those that have no discharge at all and don't require our regulatory involvement, and those which have substantial discharges and do require our involvement. And then I'll give an overview of the proposed aquatic ecosystem restoration policy, which is described in more detail in the scoping document. And again, there's copies of that up front, as well as on our website. Summarize the potential environmental impacts of policy implementation as we see it. The policy itself will be accompanied by a programmatic CEQA analysis, and individual restoration projects will continue to be required to develop site-specific CEQA analyses. And then I will highlight the next steps until that moment when we can bring a policy to you for adoption. So the reasons for an aquatic ecosystem restoration policy. Well, first of all, in 2007, the triennial review, the board directed staff to develop exemption criteria for restoration projects. We looked at other regions and states for examples of such things. We had very thorough and detailed internal discussions and discussions with other regulatory entities. And we have crafted sort of a sketch or framework of this policy based on the example that we found in the Lahontan region, and then augmented that with the conversations that we had internally and with other agencies. Another reason for developing an aquatic ecosystem restoration policy is to offer this opportunity to voice support for restoration as a tool for water quality protection, recognizing its sort of dual character as both promoting water quality in the long run, even though in some cases it has short-term water quality impacts. We want to provide greater clarity and transparency with respect to how we authorize restoration projects. We have the authority now to authorize restoration projects even when they have significant temporary impacts, but there's a number. We use a variety of tools to make that happen, and by coalescing all of that into a restoration policy, we'd be able to, just with more clarity and transparency, provide the regulated public some view of how we go about that. The proposed policy is intended to apply throughout our region, so that's all surface waters draining to the ocean from the Oregon border to San Antonio Creek. It's approximately 9,470 square miles and includes 340 miles of coastline. And unique in the state, it includes about 41% of the state's annual runoff, which just speaks to the fact that we have a lot of aquatic habitat here, much of it which has been historically very important for many aquatic species, which are now listed as threatened and endangered. So the use of restoration as a tool is a big issue and idea here in this region. So I'm going to do a brief overview of our existing regulatory framework, starting here with just an image of how our basin plan is laid out. Sort of at its foundation is the development or identification of the beneficial uses of water. And that serves as, it's sort of fundamental to all the rest of how the basin plan is built. That's our Chapter 2. In Chapter 3, we highlight all water quality objectives, both in narrative and numeric form. And those are generally related to individual parameters and describe the characteristics of water that are necessary to support the beneficial uses that we've identified for our region. And then in Chapter 4 are the plans, policies, and prohibitions, the means by which we achieve water quality objectives and support and protect beneficial uses. And, of course, in the background is always ongoing monitoring and assessment, which happens both on a site-specific scale as well as on a larger region-wide scale, and provides us with regular information to make some judgment about whether or not this plan is actually accomplishing its goals. So the beneficial uses are sort of the foundation of how our water quality protection work is set up. There are a wide range of beneficial uses, including uses that are strictly related to human activities, uses that are strictly related to environmental activities, and then a mixture of both. As I said, the water quality objectives come both in numeric and narrative form. The thing I wanted to point out here on this slide is actually at the bottom. I think this works as a pointer, yeah. There's sort of a standard phrase associated with our narrative objectives, which is, water shall not contain substances, this substance being any one of these, substances in concentrations that cause nuisance or adversely affect beneficial uses. And this phrase, serves us well in offering us, offering the ability of protecting water quality. It's also not super precise, so there's opportunity for interpretation based on site-specific characteristics. And then the next level is, how we go about implementing the water quality objectives. And one of the tools we use is waste discharge prohibitions. We have a point source discharge prohibition, which applies throughout the region except for seasonal allowance of discharge from the Russian, Eel, and Mad rivers, We also have what is, essentially a non-point source discharge prohibition, which is the prohibition pertaining to logging, construction, and associated activities. And it's designed to prevent the discharge of earthen or organic materials in quantities deleterious to fish, wildlife, or other beneficial uses. And so this is another one of those phrases which offers us a wonderful ability to protect water quality, but it's also not very precise. So there's an opportunity for interpretation on individual projects. New to the basin plan since last year is a prohibition related to discharges in violation of water quality objectives in the Klamath River Basin that was adopted as part of the Klamath TMDL. So it's a prohibition against violation of water quality objectives in the Klamath unless otherwise authorized by the Regional Water Board. Restoration projects are essentially considered construction projects, and that's how we go about authorizing them as construction projects. They're required to implement best management practices. They may receive waste discharge limitations as appropriate, and then they'd be subject to enforcement for violations. Oftentimes, they are authorized under Section 404 of the Clean Water Act by the Army Corps of Engineers as a dredge and fill project. And then in that case, they come to us for 401 certification. And that's our opportunity to determine whether any discharge associated with that project is in compliance with our basin plan or not. And then to offer whatever mitigations or limitations we think are necessary. Not all projects are going to be required to have a 404 permit. If they're a discharge to a water that's only a water of the state, then they would simply get a waste discharge requirement. So here's some pictures of some project examples. These actually are pictures that come from a presentation that you, I think, saw in September. Amy Haas from the Nature Conservancy up on Shasta Big Springs Ranch. This is an open stream channel which, after restoration has become more ecologically complex, provides a little bit more opportunity for shade. And this restoration comes from primarily the implementation of ranch management plans and the installation of exclusion fencing. So there was no activity in the stream itself, no waste discharge, and they didn't require any kind of permit from us. These are pictures also from Ms. Haas's presentation and, essentially show the same thing. The implementation of ranch management plans and exclusion fencing, over the course of almost 20 years have resulted in, thickening of the riparian zone. Oh, thank you. And a greater ecological complexity and better shade potential. But again, not requiring any kind of waste discharge requirement from us because there was no discharge associated with the project. These next slides come from Brant Gudermith and a presentation that he gave you, I think, back in March on the Trinity River Restoration Program. And this is the other extreme of the scale. This is a project which involves, or a program that involves, numerous projects and projects that have a lot of activity in the stream and do require waste discharge limitations. As described by the Bureau of Reclamation, this is a situation where decades of low flow from the dam have resulted in an encroachment of the riparian vegetation along the stream corridor and the storage of a lot of fine sediment in the upper 40 miles of the river. The result has been a reduced access to the floodplain and a loss of critical habitat and major declines in naturally spawning anadromous fish populations by the mid-1970s. So the general goals of the Trinity River Restoration Program are to alter the flow releases so that they better mimic a natural variability, to engage in a number of projects which rehabilitate the channel, and then to augment coarse sediment for spawning purposes. So these are a series of pictures that show a channel rehabilitation effort forcing a meander in a relatively straight section of stream. this is the same site here as is shown here, just, you know, one from one direction and one on the other side, looking the other direction. So this is the floodplain that in this picture is then being excavated out, creating a meander in the stream channel. All of that turbid water then is held back so that it won't be discharged to the river until it's ultimately ready. They're ultimately ready to remove this berm then and allow the stream to occupy this place. This right here is the tail end of, you know, what was a very large placement of spawning gravels. You know, this is gravel that's been at least double washed prior to its installation, and still there's a little bit of sediment that comes off when they put it in the stream. But the main issue that has arisen in looking at the Trinity River Restoration Program is that while, you know, they implement all of the best management practices and have improved those best management practices over the years as they've learned lessons, and still what happens after each of these channel rehabilitation projects or sediment installations are complete is that the next year when they go in, here on the blue line that shows flow releases, so starting in April, you know, they ramp up the flow to mimic what would happen under natural conditions, and with each of those steps up in flow comes a spike in fine sediment, and it recovers quickly, but with each ramp up, no matter how small, there's another spike. And ultimately, you know, the fine sediment comes back down, the turbidity comes back down to the same level it was, you know, at before they started this ramp up. But still, they run the risk then in this situation of exceeding our turbidity limit. And yet, here's the result of all that work. We have, you know, section of the Trinity River. The blue and red represent different qualities of juvenile rearing habitat, and this is before and then after. And so you see the huge expansion in juvenile rearing habitat that's resulted from these projects and opening up of all the sort of side channel floodplain habitat, which has had great benefits for the fish. So clearly it's a project that's supporting beneficial uses, it's supporting our cold beneficial use, and yet it has some potential, at least in the initial stages, of exceeding our water quality objectives. So that's the crux of the problem that we're trying to address by developing this restoration policy. So here's an overview of the proposed policy that's described in the scoping document. The proposed policy is meant to include a statement of support for aquatic ecosystem restoration as a water quality protection tool. And this is, if you think back to that pyramid of how the basin plan works, you know, restoration sort of does two things. On the one hand, it very wonderfully supports beneficial uses by, for example, in providing increased habitat, on the one hand. On the other hand, it runs the risk of exceeding water quality objectives. So it has this sort of, you know, two-faced characteristic. The proposed policy is intended to provide greater clarity and certainty with respect to the authorization of future restoration projects. We want to take any of the guesswork out of it and make more clear that we, you know, as an agency, do support and encourage restoration. We want to establish some sort of sidebars for the kinds of temporary impacts that are acceptable, but make sure that there's a clear and efficient path to authorizing projects that have water quality value. The proposed policy is not intended to alter the number or kinds of restoration projects the agency authorizes. It's really just meant to provide the clarity and transparency. The proposed policy includes a definition of the goals of aquatic ecosystem restoration. And I think maybe I'll read that here out of the scoping document. It's, for those who are interested, it's on page 5. It says, aquatic ecosystem restoration is the return of the chemical, physical, and biological components of an aquatic ecosystem to a close approximation of their condition prior to disturbance by recreating the ecosystem's natural structures and functions. Aquatic ecosystem restoration should result in the reestablishment of a self-regulating, resilient aquatic ecosystem that is integrated with the larger landscape in which it is located. And so this is a way of just establishing an ecological context in which we'd encourage restoration projects to be designed and implemented. It's not meant to be a criteria, and certainly not meant to exclude any projects that don't result in full ecosystem functioning. In fact, we would want to acknowledge that any water body would clearly require a number of activities to actually accomplish that goal. And then the two last things, the proposed policy includes acknowledgement of the regional board's existing authority to issue a time schedule to meet water quality objectives as appropriate. This is authority that is identified several times in Port of Cologne, but our basin plan doesn't articulate this particular authority. Clearly, you know, it's something that we use regularly. But for the purpose of restoration projects that may have a temporary impact and only achieve water quality objectives after some period of time, this is a tool that we could use to address that phenomenon. And then lastly, the restoration policy will include eligibility criteria for an exemption from discharge prohibitions. And so if you think back to the slide on our waste discharge prohibitions, the one of most consequence to restoration projects is the one related to logging and construction, which prohibits the discharge of earthen and organic material in quantities that are deleterious. This offers us an ability with establishing criteria as sidebars to exempt a restoration a project that has long-term water quality benefits from having to meet that discharge prohibition. Okay, and so for our CEQA analysis, we need to look at potential environmental impacts. It's our assessment that potential environmental impacts primarily include those that are otherwise commonly associated with construction projects. They have water quality impacts, most of them temporary, though they could be significant, habitat impacts, noise impacts from heavy equipment, air quality impacts, disruption of traffic patterns, all that sort of standard list. But an important point is that some of those temporary impacts may be significant and unavoidable, and that's a factor that we need to be able to handle. The proposed policy highlights in the form of eligibility criteria the kinds of mitigations necessary to qualify for an exemption from discharge prohibitions under the proposed policy. For those of you who are interested, I won't read this because it's a long list, but there's starting on page 11, there's a list of the proposed criteria. And again, this is, you know, our initial scope and is subject to change based on comments here today, as well as more consideration between now and the time we put out the draft policy. But a couple just to illustrate the point that, you know, we're establishing some sort of sidebars is a criteria that the timing of a discharge needs to be such as to protect the most sensitive life stages, and that any discharge should ensure access to refugia where that's necessary. This proposed policy will be accompanied by a programmatic CEQA analysis, but then project-specific or site-specific CEQA analyses will be conducted for each large-scale restoration project that's developed under this policy. So in terms of the next steps, today we're hoping to receive some oral comments from the board and from the public, and then written comments on the scoping document by November 18th. We will, with that information, develop a draft policy and staff report and bring that to you in a workshop and follow that up with a proposed policy and staff report to bring to you in a hearing so you can consider adoption of that into the basin plan. And then the general program for approval will occur after that. After adoption, the basin plan amendment is routed to the State Board and the Office of Administrative Law for their approval and then EPA for final concurrence. So that concludes my presentation, and I would be very interested in hearing comments.
We need to coordinate this with the 401 categorical exemption under CEQA state policy that's already in effect. And my concern is the goal of this is to make it easier to do restoration projects. I don't want to have this an overlay on the state exemption based upon CEQA categorical exemptions. I think we just need a careful referencing. I don't think it's a large issue. And then part of the need for this policy is a lot of the projects approved under that exemption, in fact, is are a little broader than the CEQA categorical exemptions. And but we definitely do not want to add a regulatory burden along those lines. I like that you use the Lahontan Regional Board for starting place, but ours is much, in one way, is broader, but then it's also tougher in the other restrictions. But that's because EPA has already approved it, and it will. Our audience is going to be 90% EPA, and then we got to get it through the public system to do it. I think it'd be nice if you could add some projects from the five county restoration and also Mattole Restoration Council. Now will probably build support if they even know this is happening. I liked the fact you went back to the Federal Act biological integrity and restoration language, and that's sort of fun to have. But I do think you have under basin planning provisions, the Port of Cologne Act, future probable beneficial uses, and I think it might be nice to cite that it's a way to carry out those provisions of the Port of Cologne Act as well. And then I have just some technical amendments that I'll just talk to you out of the meeting. One other thing, if you view this as trying to help people do restoration, the monitoring provisions have to be in there because it could be projects of many different scales. But I would hope for small projects, and I don't know whether you want this in the staff narrative or you want to put it in the regs, that you could have upslope compliance or compliance with the plans would be sufficient monitoring, while bigger ones, of course, you're going to need in the stick monitoring. But if you put in the stick monitoring for small ones, then we've actually hurt people trying to do restoration projects. So the language, I think, is pretty flexible the way it's written, but I want to make sure that's staff understanding as well.
Thank you. For each of those criteria, they're designed so that while that policy is written generally to apply to any restoration project, it clearly is going to most directly apply to large-scale projects that don't otherwise fall under the 401 exemption or any of the provisions under 404.
Did you have one?
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
We'll go down the line.
Alita, Trinity, the whole TRIP project already has, it has a programmatic process that Sam did, right? Is that right, Sam? What does Trinity have?
Dean Pratt, your staff, and myself worked very hard on a programmatic EIR, and also it was a federal document, a master EA under NEPA, for all of the, I think it's like 56 separate mechanical restoration projects, and then we're tiering off that document for individual 401 certs for each individual project. And there were also two other certs for their gravel injection and another dredging project as well. So it was a lot of permits.
But the upfront work that you did on that pays big dividends down the road, and that all that programmatic stuff is done.
It was very useful to do it programmatically. Now, for this policy, we're lacking any specifics, right? Because we don't have a project in front of us, so it's going to be pretty general, but it's going to be programmatic in nature. And we'll so we have some experience now, having gone through that, so we know sort of what the impacts might look like. But it's going to be very hard to it's going to be hard to say that everything can be mitigated. So we're going to be looking at some sort of programmatic override, I believe, for CEQA. We're still working around that, but so we'll do the best we can on this one.
So how does that work then? And I know, actually, Jeff, you probably have some experience on this too. I'm working on that river system. How does it work then? Somebody comes with a project, with a programmatic, with this type of policy in place. How would that work? Somebody proposes a project. It's got a programmatic system already in place. They propose a project and build that mitigation into it. on a project basis, based on time, space, and location?
I mean, presumably the CEQA document would inform most of those criteria if you read them. I mean, that kind of information gets fleshed out in a CEQA analysis so that the board, or if it's delegated, a 401's delegated, but if it's a big enough project, can come before you, and you would have enough information in front of you from the CEQA process to make those findings.
Okay.
If you didn't have one prepared yet, you'd probably prepare one, and it would happen at the same time. So the review of the exemption criteria would happen at the same time as reviewing the document and approving the project. That would happen in one procedure.
And I mean, I could see this policy John mentioned, say like the Matoll or something like that, where somebody wanted, you know, groups or something, you know, a whole watershed approach type thing. This could be really helpful to just make that happen, make it happen in a coherent manner, in a coordinated manner, in something that would be useful to not only us, but then the end user out there trying to make things happen.
Well, it's definitely meant to encourage an approach which looks specifically at restoring ecological functioning as its ultimate goal, which naturally speaks to a watershed kind of scale effort.
It does.
So it encourages that for sure. That's certainly not a requirement of the policy. But the main benefit that the policy offers to individual projects is a sort of a new set of permitting options. So as in the case of the Trinity, where they were looking at the turbidity objective and having to work within this 20% over background limit, under the restoration policy, it becomes more clear that you could use a time schedule as a tool, and you could also issue an exemption from the prohibition as a tool. So it expands those options, yeah. Which makes it clearer, more transparent, and also provides the project proponent with a little bit more ease that they're not going to be liable for some of those short-term impacts if they've taken care of the best management practices.
Right.
But as far as tearing off our programmatic, I mean, there's always been an opportunity. There is right now. If one watershed wants to consolidate a bunch of different projects and do, you know, and present it as, you know, one bigger project, that opportunity exists right now.
Yeah.
This wouldn't make it any, hopefully not any harder, but I don't think it makes it much easier. We will be able to use the programmatic, but if there's going to be significant unavoidable impacts, you're going to have to do a project-specific EIR. There's no way in this policy we can change that. So,
yeah.
But there are a lot of ways to try to. I think Shasta Watershed wanted some sort of permit for all the restoration, so you don't have to come in and get a permit every single time. And there are options available.
In some cases, looking at the Trinity, we're fortunate to have gone through that exercise because it probably represents the single largest restoration effort that we will see for a while in our region, and. You know, having gone through what we have with them and actually gone through the master EIR, seemingly other projects are going to be a little bit easier to deal with. But in concept, I think it tiered the framework up for that. So that's encouraging. One of the things that, I'm sorry, David, were you finished with your comments?
Go okay. For it.
It segued nicely. One of the other things is in terms of our mechanisms to streamline or be more efficient with other agencies, there's always other agencies that are clearly involved in doing these types of projects, and everybody's joining. And it's not that much different from the nature of some of the other projects that we issue our permits for, but if there's a way for opportunities to identify either, maybe, I don't know if it's done via Basin Plan Amendment language, if that's the appropriate place for it or not, but certainly some recognition of that and how we can avoid duplication and certainly be more efficient would be great.
I agree. And we did, in the drafting of the scoping document, toy with the idea of inserting some just general language which would offer the board an opportunity to simply encourage staff to participate in efforts that better streamline the permitting process. Mm-hmm. So that's still an open possibility.
Thanks. Anything? All right.
Unfortunately, I forgot my biggest point. And it may be when you're talking about restoring the biological integrity is a scientific way of saying it, but I do think preference should be given to projects creating volitional fish passage, whether you want that as an item 10 or in the staff report is, I'll leave to your discretion.
And just to learn a little bit more about that, are you comfortable with simply highlighting that as a preference, or are you thinking that should actually be a criteria?
No, I do not want it as a criteria. I want it as a preference.
I would think that, you know, passage is just one of many, you know, we've got our core objectives, and in satisfying those objectives, a lot of times passage becomes an automatic benefit of doing that. And so I think, you know, I wouldn't say necessarily calling out or giving preference to a particular fish passage project. I think we can still maintain our water quality goals and objectives without specifically focusing on fish passage. I think clearly it's something that, you know, most projects, a lot of projects in our region are focused on that. That's just the crux of why the work is being done in the first place. But I think more, you know, we're talking, you know, either recovering a process that provides habitat and provides the ability for fish to move. I think that's bigger than just a passage itself.
Well, the biological integrity to do it, but like the five-county project, which is the best bang for the buck, really, in fisheries restoration, they go in and they look at county culverts, and the fish can't swim up it, and they redo the culverts so they can, and that really is volitional fish passage. And I do think those kinds of projects really ought to have some benefit out of this policy.
Well, and it might be that just simply making more of an example of that as a component of ecological functioning in the staff report, describing it in more detail would be helpful.
That's a good suggestion.
Yeah.
Great. Thanks, Alita.
Yeah, and will we have an opportunity to hear public comments?
Yeah, it looks like we've got some speaker cards, so yes, we do. All right. Mr. Strufenegger, followed by Gary Rynearson.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, board members. Ed Strufenegger with the California Forestry Association. And I sort of apologize. I wrote some notes in the back, and we just got into this discussion just a second ago about the other permitting going on with these projects. But let me state that the goal of this is very good, and I think this is something that a lot of the CFA members who basically represent a majority of the larger and quite a few of the smaller landowners, forest landowners, in the region would be very supportive of. I just wanted to make a few points. First of all, there's a huge range of these kind of projects going on right now. Some are on-site mitigation, some are off-site mitigations, some are involved with the link to timber harvesting plans, some are linked to NTMPs, some are being done under bigger programmatic type of projects, part of HCPs or aquatic HCPs. And so we have a large range of these projects going on right now that basically involve a whole range of other outside agency involvement, Fish and Game, CAL FIRE, and others. So it's important to keep that in mind. A lot of these landowners are also doing projects on their own outside of a CEQA project, outside of a THP or outside of a NTMP. As part of restoration work. I know some of this stuff has gone on in some of the rivers with some of the local RCDs and getting money from Prop 40 and Prop 98 money and watershed restoration money. And so there is an entire range of projects that are being conducted now, all with their little nuances in terms of regulatory permitting and oversight and things like that. And so I basically just want to say that when the draft policy comes out, I'm hoping that they can very clearly articulate the permitting with this policy with regards to all the other projects that are going to be undertaken in forest landscapes, how that, for example, would interface with DFG permitting or CAL FIRE and things like that. And I'm also hopeful that the establishment of the timelines that was referred to and time schedule for conducting this work, keep that in mind, because in many cases, the timelines for conducting the work is very narrow, and that there may be, you know, for example, low flow, Fish and Game many times requires low flows for doing a lot of the in-stream type of work. And so I just wanted to give it as an example that let's look at the big regulatory picture when we're coming up with the final policy. But otherwise, I think there's going to be a lot of support for this policy. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, board members, Gary Reinerson, Green Diamond Resource Company. Your executive officer and I were invited to speak at a hearing held by the Joint Senate and Assembly Committee on Fisheries and Aquaculture, chaired by Assemblymember Chesbrough, about, what, 3 weeks ago, was it? It's a while. After accepting, then I learned the name of the hearing, which was Coho on the Brink. But I did start the presentation with the Coho on the Brink of a comeback. And from the standpoint of through restoration efforts and through changes in practices over time, that there are huge opportunities for improvements to continue to occur. One of the key points, and I think at the end of this hearing that everybody came away with, was that one of the greatest barriers, no pun intended, to recovery, especially of coho, was the regulatory morass to try to get through the permitting process. And it was agency v. agency saying we can't get things done because it takes too long to get the permits. It's taking 2 to 3 years and $30,000, $40,000 in some cases to get the necessary permits. So anything this process can do to expedite that permitting process and to make it faster, simpler, and cheaper is a huge opportunity. I'd also encourage you to remember that we have really three kinds of projects that occur, and all these occur on our properties in Humboldt and Del Norte and a little bit in Trinity County, but mostly Humboldt and Del Norte, is we have in-channel, near-channel, and off-channel work that's done. And sometimes those are associated with timber operations because a lot of them take big machinery that happens to be there doing road construction or timber harvesting, but mostly associated with road construction. And oftentimes they're standalone projects. We have a lot of standalone projects where we work closely with the Yurok Tribe and the Klamath System and other organizations, including the California Conservation Corps and some other nonprofit groups. So I encourage that this policy take a look at whatever programmatic approaches can be done to expedite the permitting process through the water quality requirements, and also to go back and look at, as part of the process, to identify the benefits that are already enumerated in the recovery plans, both for the state recovery plan for coho, that's a Department of Fish and Game document, and for the Central Coast ESU coho that was recently completed for the federal coho. That there are the benefits, while we're talking about restoration here, the ultimate benefit is also recovery. And I think that should be recognized through this process and identified in this CEQA scoping. So thank you.
And just to reaffirm Gary's comments, it's the citizens of California are voting through bond measures for restoration, and 20, 30, 40% is going to subsidize the California permit process. And we will get far more bang for our buck in our bonds if we have a system. This is only one tiny sliver out of the agency picture, but I think we'll get some really good results from it.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thanks, Alita.